This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Wow, what a day. This is going to be exciting. Hi, is my guest on the line? Well, I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper. I tell you, this book you will just love. And it blew my mind away. Sometimes I get a book where I just sort of fall in love with it, and this one is one that just grabbed me. It is called Arusha and the Nectar of Immortality, and it is the fifth book in a series written by, I love to say this word, a New York Times instant bestselling author, Roshana Chokshi. Hi, Roshana.
Hi, how are you?
Wow, Roshana, you are such a fabulous writer. And this series, of course, is so great, but then I wouldn't expect anything less from a Rick Riordan-selected author.
Thank you. That really means a lot to me. Also, and I totally understand, because one of the things I always end up talking about in interviews and on tour and in the books themselves is that I've got a very hard-to-pronounce name. And weirdly enough, there's like a silent A snuck in there. So I appreciate the effort, but it's actually pronounced Roshni.
How is it pronounced?
Roshni.
Roshni. Okay. Yes. Oh, I like that. Roshni. Roshni. Chokshi. Did I get that right?
Yes, you got the second one. Absolutely perfect. Almost nobody ever gets that right.
Oh, well, I'm happy about that. Wow. You know, this is such an amazing series. Because in so many ways, one, I know that it's supposed to be for middle grade, right? That's the designation I think they give it.
Yes. Yep.
They're wrong. I think it's for everybody. It is such a fun series, and it's such an intelligent series. This is not, you know, I really hope that all of our middle grade students are this smart, because you are just a writer who you don't hesitate to, you know, really get out there and use great language.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And, you know, it's been such a joy being on tour, and especially getting the chance to speak with young readers again, since I really haven't been able to do that in almost 3 years now because of the pandemic. And you will be astounded by how sweet and tender and brilliant and awkward these kids are. They're just fabulous, and they read so like well beyond their age levels. And so I often think, you know, it makes me very happy to hear that you think the books are for everybody, because I completely agree. Sometimes when we think about the designation of a book, it's more just where it sits on a bookshelf, not who it's made for.
Exactly. I cannot imagine an adult who would not enjoy this book. It's because I said, one, it's smart. It's clever. You are just such a writer. I have been recently talking a lot about writers and how they can really connect with a reader. And just a few weeks ago, we had the 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper. And I was giving out awards, and one of the awards went to Laurie M. Lee for her book.
Yes.
And, you know, because I love, and my listeners love her last book, The Pahua and the Soul Stealer. And so she got one of the first Patsy Awards.
I love that.
And, I mean, my listeners are not kids, you know. my listeners are all ages. But when I told them about that book, they were so intrigued. And I know that I'm telling them they have to read this series if they haven't already started. This book you can start right off and just go back, because it's funny. I want to mention particularly one chapter. You know, for writers, and so many of the people who listen to my program are writers, or they're dreaming of writing. And I think all of them should read chapter 12 in your book. This is an example. One little chapter is an example of perfect writing. It's called, What Do You Know? Another Family Reunion. I don't know if you had as much fun writing it as I had reading it. It's dialogue. It has dialogue. It has humor. And the most important thing, you paint a picture in words. It's a completely unusual scene, okay? I mean, I won't tell everybody what it is, but I mean, it's a scene that when you read it, you see it in your head, and I'm thinking to myself, how did she do it? And, you know, it's like 4 pages, and it is a beautiful chapter. Do you remember writing that chapter?
Oh, my goodness. I've got to be very honest with you. I don't, in the sense that, you know, one of the strange, wonderful things about writing professionally is, you know, I finished the book about a year and a half ago, so it's almost as if I'm simultaneously living in both the past and the present. And but I do remember, in the sense that there is a lot about the final book that was really emotionally heavy hitting to write. In the sense that I've always felt that, you know, the older I get and the more books that I'm writing, there's a sense that maybe the thing you need to focus on is how to polish your prose, or the most interesting plot structure, the most interesting premise. But what I really think good writing or a good story comes down to is whether or not it makes you feel anything. And being able to think about what are the moments where I think it would emotionally affect the character the most, and make that center stage, make that the main point of a scene, or make that an entire chapter, that's what I feel it resonates the most with readers.
Well, you accomplished it with this chapter and with all the chapters. This one opens up, and I want to tell, the reason I want to read the first line, because after I read it, I was holding my breath. It starts, jagged beams of light hit the ground as the ceiling opened. Now, right there, I found myself looking up at my ceiling, and I was holding my breath as I read this chapter. And you just describe it so beautifully, and the dialogue is so good and clever. I'm just in awe of somebody who can write this well.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Patsy. That really means a lot to me. I mean, I'm sure you know this too, as do your listeners, but when we write, there's something so deeply isolating about it. You know, it's really, there's nobody there except us and our thoughts and the screen or the page in front of us. So every single time that I hear or know that what I was trying to do actually worked, it's deeply, deeply humbling. Thank you.
Well, you know, when you get a reader to hold their breath, because I think every once in a while I looked up at my ceiling, never knowing if it was going to open up. And in 4 pages, you just gave me such a thrill. I love that chapter. I love the headings, Ask Julie. I like the way you've done very clever headings for each chapter. And, you know, after chapter 12, it's one of my favorite headings. Chapter 13, finally, paradise. And by that, I mean Home Depot. That is so good. And I love Home Depot, so it was really perfect.
Yeah, Home Depot's the best. It was really funny because it ends up being like the favorite place of one of the main characters. It's just, for whatever reason, the place that she always talks about is like, you know, it'd be really fun if we could wander around, we can get this thing from Home Depot or whatever. Or it shows up because, you know, it's a middle grade fantasy book. It randomly shows up in the astral plane, and her friends are all just like, why do we always end up here?
Well, I don't know if Home Depot is selling this book, but they really should put this series up with a special display and sell it. Because it's funny, when I had some surgery on my ankle a few years ago, and I couldn't walk for a while. And one of the joys of my life at that time, because I needed to get out and the weather wasn't good, and I couldn't walk, I would go into Home Depot and take one of those carts, and I would drive up and down the aisles, up and down. I just had so much fun. So
it's really fun. I love that.
Yeah. And, well, this book is filled with humor. which I'm sure it connects so well with the children because the dialogue is very fast, very clever. It's all across the board, you know, from the descriptions to the dialogue to the headings for the chapters. It's a perfect book.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
So when you became that overnight instant best-selling author, that must have been pretty impressive for you.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I'll be very honest with you. I think when any publicity department writes instant best-selling whatever, that's mostly just for the PR purposes. I don't believe that there's any such thing as an overnight success in so many ways. I mean, I've been writing for years. I've got far more rejections than I ever got yeses in anything. But in terms of, like, being able to hit the New York Times best-selling list with so many of my novels, there's something, it's very, very humbling, you know, like, because, again, it feels so far out of your control. There's so many things that are at play, whether reviewers think about it, whether it's picked up by distribution, all those, frankly, unmagical parts of writing, which remind you that it's a business. Publishing is a business, and sometimes your book is less a work of art and more a bottom line for somebody. But that's where the magic of writing really comes into play. It's the sense of, do I feel like I honored my very best ability to tell the story I wanted to tell? Can I make peace with that? And if I did, great. And if it hits the list, amazing. And if not, then at the very least, I can go to sleep knowing that I gave it everything I had.
Well, you certainly have. And of course, it's been selected by Times Magazine as 100 best fantasy books of all time for that list. The School Library Journal loves it. I think everybody loves it. You know, this is always the exciting thing. As you said, when you started writing, did you ever expect this kind of success?
Oh, gosh, not at all. It's so strange. I feel yesterday was rather funny. I just did an event in Houston, and I remember this little kid. I mean, he must have been like 11 years old. He raised his hand and he asked me whether I did this for the fame and the riches. And I was like, "No, child, I've got a mortgage. I don't know about all that." But like, I think that that sense of like, why do we start writing, or why did I even do this? And it came down to this idea that I can't think of anything that lives longer than a story. You know, sometimes I'll go to these parties with my husband and his, you know, physician colleagues and stuff, and they'll ask me questions like, well, when are you going to write something that's just for adults or that's, you know, more literary? And by that, they mean more highbrow. But one thing I will never forget is I believe that even when you're on your deathbed, you're never going to forget how Beauty and the Beast ends, that there's something very critical, very vital about fairy tales and telling these sorts of stories. And that's why I got into it. That's all I really wanted to do, was to play with something essential and hope that maybe it would live longer than me.
Well, I'm sure this will. And as I said, it is not for... I wish they wouldn't just market it with this middle grade on it, because I know they're, you know, this wonderful designation, but I know teenagers who would love this, college students who would love this, because it's magical. And I think I love particularly the stones. We'll talk about, I don't know what you want to mention about the basic premise. You know, let's go back a little bit and step back, because I'm so excited about the book, but the overall storyline.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the overall storyline is, you know, about the main character, Ari Shah, and it's sort of like Percy Jackson meets Sailor Moon with a great big heaping dose of Hindu mythology. And in the very first book, Ari Shah and the End of Time, we meet Aru, who's 12 years old. She lives in the Museum of Ancient Indian Art and Culture in Atlanta, Georgia. And she ends up by, you know, she's a bit of a liar, so this ends up getting her into a sticky situation where she ends up having to light this ancient lamp that lets out a demon who is hell-bent on ending time. And in addition to that, she also discovers that she is the reincarnation of an ancient Indian hero. And not just that, but that she's a demigod. She is the daughter of the god of thunder and lightning. And in each successive book, we meet a new bond of a sister. And the source material for the story was the ancient Sanskrit poem, the Mahabharata, because when I was growing up, this was the sort of stories that my grandmother would read to me.
And, you know, the wonderful thing about the entire Rick Riordan series that takes mythology from different countries and brings it, you know, brings it up to, you know, the entire public now that didn't know anything about the different countries and the different mythologies.
Yeah, I mean, working with Rick Riordan has been such a joy. I mean, he's obviously iconic in the entire, you know, in the entire, frankly. I mean, his nickname is the Storyteller of the Gods because of all that he's done with Greek mythology, Roman mythology, Norse mythology. And I'm just so grateful that he has took the time and had the generosity of spirit to share that spotlight with writers of underrepresented cultures and heritages.
And, of course, for you, as you said, your grandmother told you so many of these stories that, and, of course, India is so rich in stories anyway. It's just wonderful that people are getting to learn about them.
Yes. It's wonderful. Exactly as you said, and I think what makes me so very happy is that there used to be this old idea in publishing that a child was only interested in reading a book about characters that looked like them. And that was sort of their excuse for not publishing stories with, you know, Indian mythology or Filipino folklore, that sort of thing. And I have never found that to be true. I mean, one of my favorite stories growing up was Watership Down, and I believe I don't look anything like a rabbit. And yet, there's something about it that speaks to the universality of human interaction and human experience. And that is why I love being able to go to these events, seeing children of all different kinds of races who are able to find something to laugh at, to see themselves in with the Arusha series. It is deeply humbling and extremely validating.
And also that the heroine or is a girl. And so often I know that publishers thought, well, if we, you know, Harry Potter was a guy, it was okay. He'd also have female, you know, girl followers. But yeah, they weren't sure about whether boys would read this book. And I know that boys are reading it just as much as girls, and they don't mind at all having a strong girl.
Yeah, they don't mind this idea that, of course, it was wonderful to write a story that's centered on girl power. It doesn't mean that you're saying down with all men. It's just saying, I'd like some room at this table, too. And it turns out everybody can enjoy themselves. I find it's so refreshing to have this conversation because I feel like diversity does not not need to be the point of a story. It could just be incidental, like putting on a pair of sunglasses and that's how you view the world. And I feel like that's the best thing that we can do for our young readers, present things to them not just as issues but just other facets of light, other sides of a jewel, that sort of thing.
Well, it's like For those of us who loved Kipling as a kid, I mean, I loved any story set in India. As a matter of fact, it sort of became an obsession with me to such a level.
Wonderful. Yeah.
That I read
of Rikki Tikki Tavi.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they were fun.
I love stories set in India, so much so that I am writing a book set in India in 1875. So, you know, it really is wonderful, wonderful that you are bringing this series, you know, brought this series out, and that more and more people will be interested in India, because when my book comes out one day, if I ever finish it, I want people interested in India.
Yes, India has such a just vast, intricate history, and it's always wonderful to see people take renewed interest in it.
Well, I was planning to go there last year. Of course, this pandemic sort of destroyed all of my plans. But as I said, because my book is set in India in 1875 in Baroda, I wasn't able to go. But yeah, I live in hope.
Live in hope. Yeah, that's interesting. My father's from Baroda.
No.
Yes. Yeah, my father's Gujarati.
Well, I'm learning Gujarati. Listen, you know what I did? I can sit down and draw a map of Baroda in 1875 that includes all the buildings. Wow, this is fantastic. Oh, boy.
That's fascinating. I love that. Well, I wish you all the best of luck in your writing.
Well, I'm getting there. As I said, I love it. And I love this. This book is so good. Your book is so good. And I want everyone to get it. Really, it's called Arusha and the Nectar of Immortality. And you have a website you want people to go to?
Oh. Yes. You can visit me online at www.roshanichokshi.com. That's spelled R-O-S-H-A-N-I-C-H-O-K-S-H-I.
And they can find out more about you there, and I'm sure you're on Facebook, and they can...
Yes. We do post some things on Facebook, but you can more often find me on Instagram at Roshni Chokshi.
Okay. Well, I am just so thrilled to talk to you and so thrilled to find out about your dad. This is wonderful. this is what I call, you write about magical things in your book, and I love the singing stones. I'm very connected to stones because I grew up on Lake Michigan, and my whole childhood was spent collecting agates. I love stones, and when I was reading this book, I kept having this vision of my childhood spent along the shores of Lake Superior collecting agates. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. Really clever, smart, everything I can say about it. And what I like is I want to just mention one more time, that you write in a way that makes, I'm sure, that expands a child's mind. Because I love where you write about a quote. Most authors wouldn't throw this in to a kid's book. And it is near the end. It's where you have a chapter called Bliss. And I love what you write, that Kara had always thought the phrase, ignorance is bliss, was weak. The full line was, where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise. And that it comes from a 1742 poem by Thomas Gray. This is so nice that you did this. You're treating your readers as intelligent people. And I think that your readers will respect you and admire you for that.
Thank you very much. That really means a lot to me.
Well, you are amazing. I'm just, again, thrilled that you were on Joy on Paper today. And I will have you back. Well, is this really book five? Is it the end?
Yes, it is the end.
No, I'm not ready. I am not ready for the end. I knew it was the end, and I kept saying, no, it can't be the end. I want more. Maybe I'll go around Home Depot, maybe. Anyway, I hope you get some more ideas. I'm sure you're already working on your next series. Yep.
Working on something new. Can't quite talk about it, but very excited.
Well, then you'll be back. Again, thank you so much. And say a special hello to your dad. This is fantastic. Anyone from Baroda is a friend of mine. Okay?
All right. Take care. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now. You're a joy.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow. Isn't that nice? Somebody from Baroda. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. If you know anybody from Baroda, I would love to talk to them. This is an absolute thrill for me. This is one of these magical threads that connects me to so many of the authors who are on my program. And to have somebody whose father is from Baroda, where my book is set, and someday we'll finish this book, I hope. And then we can talk more about Baroda and about all of the wonderful things that I know about India. You will love this book. Roshni is a fantastic author, and I just love her writing, and it's Arusha and the Nectar of Immortality. If you have a kid in your if you have a kid in your family, send them this book. If you don't, buy it today and send it to a children's hospital. A kid in a hospital would love this book. This book will take them traveling in their minds away from their aches and pains and whatever they're suffering from in the hospital. This book, I tell you, it's so wonderful. The storyline is fantastic, and the dialogue is top-notch. Really a fine, fine author, and she deserves to be a New York Times best-selling author. You don't get writing like that every day. So I'm really thrilled, again, that she was on the program. And we're going to talk. I'm just waiting for a minute for my next author because, again, I have all these lovely connections to authors. And this one, the next book I'm going to talk about, of course, is a Nat Geo book. I've already been promoting it on my website because I love National Geographic. I was born for National Geographic. Hello. Okay. Well, I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper. Wow. A National Geographic book is always a thrill for me. And David Litschweiger has written a book called Octopus, Seahorse, Jellyfish. What a book. Hi. Are you there?
Hello. I'm here.
Okay. Well, David, this book is so beautiful. I've spent hours with this book. I go through it, and then I go back, and I go back through it again. Of course, the writing is wonderful, but the photography is amazing. So tell us about this, your love. Obviously, you love octopus, seahorse, and jellyfish, and let's talk about them.
Well, yes, it is. I guess it's a letter of affection, in a certain sense, for these creatures. I had the great pleasure to be introduced to most of them by, you know, scientists and aquarists, people in public aquariums that take care of these creatures and, you know, breed them and share them. So I have the great pleasure and honor and privilege to work with a lot of people whose enthusiasm and care for these creatures is, you know, beyond what I would be individually capable of. So,
well, let's start with the octopus. I love the all the photographs, and tell us about what you discovered about octopus. You know, one tends to want to say octopi, but I know it's octopuses.
I think, you know, that's, you know, octopi, I think both are actually accepted by, you know, Webster's Dictionary because octopi has become common usage. But the fact is octopus is a Greek word, so octopus is actually more correct. It's what I've learned. And octopus come in a range of sizes from little tiny, you know, 1-inch tall adults, 1-inch long, to, you know, the giant Pacific octopus, which is, you know, as big as a person. They're relatively short-lived, the coastal varieties. The deep-sea ones are, you know, long-lived because they live down in the dark and the cold. But their metabolism is sort of high speed. They're, you know, magnificent creatures. They grow really fast. They don't have any backbone. They have a really small brain, but they have a neural network that's fantastic that we're just learning about. So their intelligence doesn't come from their brain. It comes from their neural network, which is an entirely different way of being from us. So I find that fascinating and wondrous, and they're truly, you know, extraordinary, you know, different from us. So
you know, when I was going through the book and I see the varieties, the amazing, sometimes the colors, the shapes of their tentacles, it's what I wonder about is, you know, when we sort of over the years, people got really frightened of octopus. There was a monster in the deep. but they are such beautiful animals. And I'm hoping that more people will understand, as you said, we're learning more and more about just in general neural systems because of their very interesting and complex system of neurons.
Yeah, it's like it's a distributed network rather than, you know, central control, which is that's a new thing to us. So it'll be really interesting to see, you know, what we can learn. But that just, to me, that just shows how much there is to learn about all of the world. I mean, there's a jellyfish called the crystal jellyfish that I had the privilege to photograph that is the source of green fluorescent protein, which is used in microbiology as a marker for protein. And so just the amount of the contribution to human well-being that a single species of quote-unquote lowly jellyfish can provide us with is, you know, is fantastic. And so that's amazing.
It is. And, you know, as you said, in this book, one of the things that I found fascinating, and again, you know, what Nat Geo does to preserve and conserve animals is so important. All of the work that they've been doing for over 100 years to make people aware of the importance of protecting animals. In the chapter about jellyfish, it was heartbreaking to read how many the chapter about seahorses. Seahorses are so beautiful. And I was shocked. I had no idea the number of seahorses that are killed each year for no reason. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Seahorses, unfortunately, live quite near us often. You know, they seagrass beds are under tremendous pressure from agricultural runoff and other near-coastal disturbances. They also are, those habitats are subject to global warming and also ocean acidification changes the makeup of coral reefs. So there's incredible pressure, but we have the opportunity to address these concerns. So I'm just hoping that we can all participate to make things better rather than worse.
Well, I hope so, because it is very, very sad that we are losing, I think in the book it mentions 90% of the seahorse population. And so much of it is they're deliberately like farming these, you know, seahorses for trinkets, for jewelry, for just to, it's ridiculous. Anyone who buys any of this, if they're on vacation and they buy dried, you know, seahorses, it's a shame. You should not do that and to buy it, you know, for trinkets. It's ridiculous because they are such lovely. Aren't they amazing? The way they work and the way they move.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I mean, seahorses are a subset of pipefish, and there's actually only about 50 species of seahorses worldwide, but they're so perfectly adapted to their niche that, you know, they're a fish that doesn't actually swim very well, but they don't need to, and they're so precisely fit into their ecological niche in a magnificent way. And recognizing that and seeing how well made they are and how long they've been around and how widespread they are in these little tiny niches, you know, is, you know, they're extraordinary, magnificent creations in and of themselves that are worthy of our affection.
Well, you enjoy working with small animals, I think.
I do. I'm fascinated with, you know, most of the diversity of life is less than an inch long. And so, you know, we're big, lumbering creatures in a certain sense. And so, you know, we're kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room. But if we take the time to look closely, there's a lot of joy and fascination in participating in the beauty of the natural world, I think.
Definitely. And you've done a beautiful job with this book, again, a National Geographic book. And I love the stories and the essays by Elizabeth Colbert, Jennifer Holland, and Olivia Judson. And, of course, your photographs. The book is called Octopus, Seahorse, Jellyfish. And I hope that people will get this book. It's the kind of book that you want to keep. You go through it. A wonderful gift book. We're going to be coming up pretty soon on Mother's Day and Father's Day. And a Nat Geo book is the best gift in the world because people can give flowers, but a book that stays on you know, on the coffee table is a book, is a treasure. And if you're looking for a book to give to somebody, this book is lovely. Your photography is amazing. The colors, one of them, the octopus with the blue, that blue is so brilliant and so beautiful. I was just stunned by it.
Yeah, those guys are great. But that blue is also a warning signal. That's not an octopus that you want to touch. Highly poisonous. But a spectacular creature. But they're only about 4 inches or 5 inches across. They're small, but they're totally lovely.
They are. It's amazing. It's wonderful that you managed to capture the personality of an octopus. I love the southern keeled one with his big eye and his the big sac behind it. Looks like a face, and you've just captured it perfectly.
Yeah, that was a really lovely creature. That was a great day, that one.
Their eyes are just mesmerizing. You want to just stare into them, and just right across the board, every one. I love the close-ups of the eyelids that you did here. That's difficult photography.
Yeah, and the octopus where you can actually see the shape of its cornea, the lens of its eye, I learned that, you know, an octopus's eye is actually, from an evolutionary point of view, a better design than ours, you know, physically. Because the light-sensitive, the retina is in front, whereas the light-sensitive portion of our retina is behind the blood supply. So we have to have this tremendous brain in order to have all this software to fix our vision, whereas an octopus's eye is actually seemingly a better design. Now, some scientists would take serious issue with me saying that because evolution doesn't need to get it perfect. It just needs to get it good enough.
Well, what camera do you use to get these close-ups of such tiny animals?
I use a digital DSLR made by Canon, for the most part. But there are many cameras capable of the same feats of resolution. But I love, you know, the current technology and how it makes more things possible.
Well,
you know, every day.
Well, they are just beautiful. All your photographs are beautiful. And I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Again, everyone should get a Nat Geo book as a gift all the time. These are the books. One thing about Nat Geo books, I can tell you, no one ever gives them away. They are really treasured books. In a household that has Nat Geo books, the Nat Geo books always take pride of place because people just love to see them and to read them because the quality is top-notch. And, of course, the photographers and the writers are always the best. And you are among the very, very best. By the way, I love that one, the pot-bellied seahorse. I was thrilled with that photograph.
That's pretty good. I mean, I think a male seahorse giving birth was a fantastic thing to be able to see.
Well, that exactly that. It's not what right now in the news are always talking about pregnant males. Well, in the case of a seahorse, the male is the pregnant one, and how you capture that photograph is amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. I went to a place in Tasmania that raises seahorses. It's kind of a seahorse farm, so to speak. And they help aquariums be able to show and share seahorses with the world, without further extracting them from the wild. So it was a fantastic place to be able to visit and a great opportunity to be able to show how they do it.
Well, it's a brilliant photograph, and I would think it's an award-winning photograph because you don't see that every day. That's really a fantastic, fantastic photograph. And again, thank you so much for being on the program today. David Litschwager, is there a website you want people to go to, or do they?
Go take a deep dive into octopus, seahorse, jellyfish. There's lots of things. There's a National Geographic magazine article out this month about seahorses in particular. And there's the book. There's my own website that, Litschwager.com, LIITTSCHWAGER.COM. And there's lots of interesting things that are referenced in all of those places.
Okay. Well, and I love the spelling of your name. So it's real easy, actually, to find, because there are not too many people who have L-I-I. It makes it real easy to find you.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, thank you so much, and thank Nat Geo for making this possible. It's a wonderful book, and I really appreciate you being on Joy on Paper today.
I really appreciate it, too. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, bye-bye now. Bye. Okay. Wow. It is. My goodness. This book it's so inexpensive. Nat Geo books are priced right. They are the very, very best books to give as a gift. And we're going to be talking a lot about the different books for Mother's Day and Father's Day coming up. It's already April, my goodness. Okay, let's do our commercials. We'll come back, and then we will talk about something else, too.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757. 3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the Joker in Batman. Each is an antagonist. When it comes to storytelling, each brings something special to the table. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. An antagonist represents a roadblock, an obstacle, a challenge. He or she or it stands in the protagonist's way, keeping them from reaching their goal. Antagonists are often villains, like the bad guys who take on James Bond, Oddjob, Goldfinger, and Jaws, the towering assassin with steel teeth. An antagonist doesn't have to be a person, however. It might be an organization like Spectre, Hydra, or Chaos. Or it could just be a bunch of flying monkeys out to ruin the hero's day. The prime purpose of antagonists is to bring conflict to the story. Sometimes the antagonist is a friend, like Iago in Shakespeare's Othello. Sometimes it's a snake, like Satan in the Garden of Eden. Sometimes it's your biggest fan, like Annie Wilkes in Stephen King's Misery. Here are some other examples. Norman Bates in Psycho, Darth Vader in Star Wars, Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life. My favorite antagonist is Harry Lime in The Third Man, but I also like The Alien in Alien, The Terminator in Terminator, and Bonnie and Clyde in Bonnie and Clyde. You could say there were two antagonists in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the doctor and the monster, because, let's face it, both were monsters in their own way. What about Herman Melville's Moby Dick? Who was the real villain, Captain Ahab or the White Whale? Speaking of captains, consider Captain Bligh in Mutiny on the Bounty, Captain Queeg in Caine Mutiny, and Captain Hook in Peter Pan. You might ask, why must our hero face so many problems? Great question. Here's why. Because a good guy like Sherlock Holmes must bump into a really bad guy like Professor Moriarty to find out just how good he really is. Know what I mean? I'm Jim Lamb, and you just learned a little something-something about antagonists.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
I'm back for a few minutes. I have a few more minutes. Couple of things I want to mention. First of all, Jim Lamb did a wonderful, wonderful literary gem for us. He's bringing us the elements of writing, and I want to thank Jim Lamb for that. Then I want to mention Bill Larson is coming on the program in a few next week. I think it's next week. And he is going to be talking again about intellectual property. He will also talk about everybody really, really think about what you are writing on Instagram and Facebook before you write it, because we've heard a few bad stories lately about people who are in trouble because they have said too much or said the wrong thing, and you do not want to get sued. And that's why it is always great if you know an intellectual property lawyer and you have one sort of in your back pocket, because you never know when something will happen. We are also going to be talking about registering and trademarking a name. Recently in the news, of course, there's a big news that Meghan Markle wants to wants to register a name, a very famous word, and she wants to take that word as her own word. Now, this is an interesting concept, and some of you have written to me and you said, you know, you have a word that you want to register as a trademark. And I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about what you can do about registering names, not just of your characters, of words that you use, and also your book titles. It's a complicated process, so you have to think about what you're doing. And Jim Lamb's going to be listening in, but Bill Larson will tell us about what you can actually do. So before you get your hopes up that you can take a word and everybody's going to pay you a fortune to use that word, please don't start spending the money, because I think you're going to find out that it's not so easy to take a word and make people pay for it. So that's if you have a question, but if you have a question, send it to me. It's patsy.radio@gmail.com, and I will have it ready for Bill Larson to answer when he comes in here, because, I have mentioned before in the past, I was involved in a major lawsuit one time, and I was unfortunately represented by a kid who just finished law school. So you can imagine where it went from there. So you want always to have a great intellectual property lawyer, and Bill Larson of Larson & Larson is a great lawyer. He belongs to APLAW, which is the Intellectual Property Lawyers Association, and he also does patents. So anyway, time's running out. I just want to remind everyone, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. If you're very lucky to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your work, your book, will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. So start writing today, and who knows, next year you might be a guest here on Joy on Paper. And one final word, too. If your electric bill shocks you like my electric bill shocked me, you might want to think about going solar, or at least getting new windows and getting new insulation. And so you should visit it's www.goehs, and they have everything that you need to make sure that you can cut down on your electric bills, because they're frightening. They're terrifying. Anyway, worse than a giant octopus. Say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Oh boy, Ed, thank you. 7 years and counting. We're doing pretty well. And he saluted me. I saluted him, because I should have been a general. My goodness, aren't you impressed with what the generals in Ukraine are doing? Okay, everybody. Bye-bye now.